Lord willing, you are now being recorded. Tonight we're going to be looking at chapter 5 of Job. I want to remind you that this is the second half of Eliphaz's speech. As I reminded you last time, Eliphaz is giving the first speech of the friends, which signifies he's probably the most prominent. There are a number of other things in the book as well in terms of the length of his speeches and his own description of his own gray hairs and so on, which suggests that Eliphaz is the most prominent among Job's friends. And he realizes it. He speaks as someone who is expecting to be listened to. He's used to having people defer to his judgment. Last time we saw this man who's very wise from a human point of view, talk about the accumulated wisdom of the ages, and he was applying that to Job. Then he had this rather strange thing he did where he talked about this sort of vision he had. I'm not really sure what to make of it, but there's this spirit that comes to him in the night somehow. But what he's saying is in addition to this hidden, this wisdom of the ages, I've had a supernatural revelation that speaks to Job's situation. Not to stop there, he goes on for an entire additional chapter that we're going to look at together this evening. I think it's helpful to look at tonight's passage under three headings. I get these from Christopher Ashe's very, very good, very helpful commentary on Job, which, by the way, is not a technical commentary. So if any of you are looking for a plain English, almost sermon-like commentary on Job, Christopher Ashe is an excellent selection. And the three titles he has for tonight are three pieces of advice for Job. Be realistic, be humble, be submissive. Let me give those to you again. Be realistic, be humble, be submissive. And you can see in the abstract, those are really good ideas, right? In the abstract, we should all be realistic. We should see the world as it is, not as we wish it was. We should see things in light of what God says, not how we otherwise might hope it would be. We should be realistic. We should be humble with God. We should be humble with one another. And by submissive, he means be submissive under God's will. Accept God's chastisement, respond to it, and so on. So in the abstract, this is really, really good advice. The question is it an appropriate advice that's rightly being applied to Job? In order to see that, we have to dive into the passages. So I want to begin with the first section, which I've following Christopher Ashe and calling Be Realistic, which is verses 1 through 7. Would someone like to read verses 1 through 7 for us?
I can read it.
Thank you, Jason.
Call now. Is there anyone who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn? Surely vexation kills the fool, and jealousy slays the simple. I have seen the fool taking root, and suddenly I cursed his dwelling. His children are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate, and there is no one to deliver them. The hungry eat his harvest, and he takes it even out of thorns. And the thirsty pant after his wealth. For affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. But man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward.
That last verse is probably the most famous from this section, but I want to focus a bit on the first verse. It's one that really strikes me and cuts to the heart of Eliphaz's view and how useful his advice may or may not be. Eliphaz says, call now, is there anyone who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn? Now, these are rhetorical questions, and they are expecting a negative answer. That is, there is no holy one for you to call out to who's going to answer you. Now, realize here, he's not talking about God. It's holy ones, plural. And what he's saying is that there's no supernatural being above you who is going to listen to you and explain what's going on to you or who's going to intervene on your behalf. So here's my question for all of you. What, in fact, is Eliphaz denying? What is Eliphaz declaring when he says, there is no holy one who will answer Job's cries or to whom Job can turn?
God doesn't hear your prayers.
God doesn't hear your prayers might be a good answer, but I don't think he's talking about God. He's saying holy ones, plural. And normally Eliphaz talks of God in the singular.
There's no mediator?
Who said there's no mediator?
Ron!
I think that's a great answer. He's saying there's no mediator for you. You'll recall that John Kammerman made this point last week, is that Eliphaz doesn't talk about a Messiah, a Christ. And here he's actually explicitly denying that there's a mediator that's going to listen to Job and act on his behalf in heaven. Although, as Job points out, while I don't think it's the direct thing he's going to, he's also making a claim about God. What is Eliphaz's view of God? Anybody?
It seems that Eliphaz is a little deistic in his view of God. That, like, he just sets things in motion and doesn't really interact with his creation.
Yeah, so that's what you mean by deism. I think we're going to find out that it's not quite deistic. So how else might we talk about it?
Maybe just apathetic?
Yeah. Any other ideas? Zach, is he apathetic about his creation, like he doesn't care whether or not right or wrong is being done?
Well, that's kind of hard to say, like, just from right now.
Yeah, you have to read the rest of the chapter.
Yeah. But it just kind of seems that, like, Eliphaz doesn't have a very high view of God.
High in what way?
High in, like, the same sense that, like, Job has a view of God, where, like, Job worships Yahweh. Like, he gives, like, full burnt offerings. He, like, trusts in Yahweh. And, like, you know, we know later on in the book that Job actually, you know, says that, you know, my Redeemer lives. He knows that there's the promise for a Messiah. But Eliphaz just doesn't seem to have that same reverence and view of Yahweh as Job does.
Well, that's interesting. Well, I want to hold that thought as we read through the rest of the chapter. But I do want you to perhaps see that there's another view of God. So if I miss this, please come back to it. It's not that I don't think that Eliphaz is saying that God doesn't care about what's going on in creation, but I think it's something else. And I think in one sense, he might be viewed in our society as having a high view of God. But we'll have to see how that plays out in the rest of the chapter. I do think it's important for us to see that Eliphaz is denying the very thing that will eventually give Job hope, that there is, in fact, a mediator between God and man. There's a Redeemer, right? Job will say, I know my Redeemer lives, and in my own flesh I will see him. So I think that's actually an incredibly important thing, and it impacts our view of God, because God is the one who establishes the mediator. Right? Job doesn't establish the mediator with God. God takes the step, and actually we know from the New Testament, although this isn't clear from the book of Job itself that Job knows this, that the Lord himself is the mediator. Right? So that gives us a view of God that is all-powerful, but also loves us intimately. And I think we're going to see that that's not actually the view that Eliphaz has of God at all.
David, it almost, in a way, sounds like Eliphaz is thinking about a higher power. You know how people speak of a higher power instead of speaking about the living and true God?
Yeah, that's interesting. So you can think higher power. Let's read through the rest of the chapters, though. I think we're going to see this higher power acts in history according to Eliphaz. He does things according to Eliphaz. So I don't think you want to think of him as being completely deistic. But I'd rather you just see that from the chapter itself. But what's he telling Job? He's saying, Job, you have these questions that you want answered. You have these concerns you want answered, and there is no mediator for you. You're not going to get them answered. Look at verse 2. What's he saying in verse 2? Don't wear yourself out with things that are too high for you, right? Surely vexation kills the fool, and jealousy slays the simple. Jealousy there doesn't mean like being jealous of someone else. It just has this idea of, I have these really, really deep emotions about these concerns I have. And Eliphaz is saying, look, you're never going to get answers to those things. You know, people are just going to wear themselves out on earth with all these speculative questions and concerns and problems. You got to live with reality. The reality is, if we do go back to a bit of the deism, God's up there, you're down here, and you don't have access to heaven. So don't squander your life going, what's God doing? What's going on? Right? Now, you understand from a human standpoint, that could actually seem pretty wise. In verses 3 through 7, Eliphaz introduces a new basis for his wisdom. Remember, previously he had spoken in terms of the accumulated wisdom of the ages and also this kind of supernatural revelation he had. Now he says, I have seen, which is actually a pretty common way to gain wisdom and also to talk with other people. You could say, hey, you know, when I was running a business project at Oracle or IBM or wherever you happen to have been, and we had something come up like this, we tried what you're saying and it didn't work for these reasons. And then we tried this and it worked better. Why don't you just jump ahead to the thing that worked better? Right? That's a way we get wisdom in life. I have experience. And that's what he's saying here. He's saying, I've observed the world, I have seen, and I want to tell you what I've seen. But I want you to consider how insensitive what he says is actually to Job. Because what he says, I have no doubt he's actually seen. But think about saying this in front of Job with Job's unique experiences. Verses 4 and 5. His children are far from safety. I think whose children? The fool's children. The person who's acting foolishly is who he's talking about here. And he says, his children are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate, and there is no one to deliver them. The hungry eat his harvest. He takes it even out of thorns, and the thirsty pant after his wealth. Now, Job's children have all suddenly died. It's almost unspeakable to think about losing all your children in the same accident, as it were. Job has lost his health. Job has lost the vast majority of his wealth. And what Eliphaz is doing is saying, well, you know, I've seen these things, and I have some experience with what happens to fools. Now, is what he's saying, in fact, true? Yeah. You all probably, if you're older, you've seen people who act, go through life in a very foolish way, who make a ruin of their wealth, make a ruin of their family, make a ruin of their home, maybe make a ruin of their own health. It's not that what he's saying isn't true. He probably really did see all these things. But do you see how incredibly insensitive it is to say to somebody who's just lost his children, well, by the way, I know how people suffer like this. Fools do. Right? So it's not only are you suffering terribly, but perhaps it's even your fault. I want to suggest that Eliphaz isn't even thinking in that category. I may be wrong. There's a division among commentaries on this. Some commentators think that he's starting right out and saying, Job, it's your fault. You acted like a fool. That's why all these bad things have happened to you. I want to suggest another possibility, at least for you to consider, which is he's not saying that. What he's simply doing is saying, I'm a wise man. I'm going to give you a whole bunch of wisdom that I've learned over time about suffering, even though it doesn't apply in this particular case, right? He's missing the connection to the person there that's right in front of him who's suffering. And by the way, this can be a temptation for you too. When you're with someone who's suffering and you have like one bit of wisdom, you may want to tell them that and not realize that it isn't actually truth being told in love. And of course, we also know in this case, it's entirely wrong. Job is not suffering because he's been foolish. He is not suffering because he's been unrighteous. He is suffering to the glory of God. So as I say, I seriously doubt that Eliphaz had thought through the connection between what he's saying and Job. That is, I don't think he's saying, Job, you're suffering because you're bad or you're suffering because you're foolish. But what he's saying could easily be taken that way. But even though I say that, he comes pretty close in verse 6. Look at verse 6 with me. For affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. Isn't he saying there, you know, these troubles don't just happen to you. These troubles come upon you because you've acted foolishly in the past. There's a cause and effect relationship, and your behavior, your choices are the cause that have led to this problem. Part of the reason why I don't think that's actually what he's getting at is he almost says the very opposite in verse 7. Right? He takes these two things and he smashes them together. In verse 6, he says, for affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. That is, it's the fault of your choices. In verse 7, he says, but man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. That is, in saying, be realistic, he's saying, you know, it's part of the human lot. You're born into this world. You as a human being should expect trouble. It's the normal lot of being a human being. Now, we might say those two things aren't very consistent. And maybe Eliphaz would say, you know, that consistency, a foolish consistency, is the hobgoblin of small minds, right? That these two things are both true if we can see them rightly. But just think about these three things going together. Right? He's saying, be realistic. Why should you be realistic? What does that mean? Foolish behavior leads to disaster, right? That's the first thing he's saying. The first thing he's saying is, you don't have a mediator. You don't have a way for heaven to hear you. Don't wear yourself out worrying about things that are too high for you. Be realistic. Second, be realistic. Bad things happen because of foolish choices. And third, be realistic. Bad things happen because you're a human being, right? So I think those things can kind of go together as a package, is be realistic, but they may not be that helpful. So let me pause there and ask what questions you have about the first 7 verses, or comments or thoughts. We are going to come back a little bit to his view of God, hopefully, as we read through this.
I have a question.
Sure, Tom.
Could verses 1 and 2, I have it in a short commentary too, the idea of appealing to the holy ones, but could 1 and 2 simply be an exclamation that the way that Eliphaz is saying, Job, you have no case? In other words, making it more of an explanation than a denial of the possibility of a redeemer, because later Eliphaz says to Job he would appeal to God. I'm not saying it was right, but that's what, you know, we're almost ready to read that verse, right?
Yeah, Tom raises a really good question. I actually kind of wrestled a bit how those verses of he's going to say appeal to God fit together with here you don't have any case. What I'm going to ask when we get there is, what does he actually mean by appeal to God? Because I think that's kind of a tricky question. There are people that suggest that he's saying you don't have a case in heaven, because this language of calling in this sense can actually be used as courtroom sort of language. I don't think that's right. One of the difficulties with reading poetry is sometimes you go, I don't know. It could kind of go either way. I don't think that's right. I think he's actually saying there's no one listening to you. Of course, even if it's you don't have a case, you do have a problem here, because the case that Job needs to have presented is not simply I'm innocent. It's he does need to have a mediator that speaks with God on his behalf. So I kind of think either way you end up with a bit of a mediator. But I think actually, in my judgment, it leans more toward there's no one up there listening to you. And that actually fits better with the idea of vexation and worrying about this is going to wear out you if you do it, because it wears out the fools when they do it. But Tom, that's certainly possible. Do you think that's the other alternative is better for some reason, or the one that you presented?
No, it was just one of the first things I thought of when I read it. That's all. Yeah. I just thought it fit.
It does. It is a view that's held by some commentators, because that language of calling can be courtroom type language. I don't see this as a courtroom scene. I think he's talking more generically of you don't have anyone up there listening to you, and you certainly don't have a mediator between you and God. And to me, when you read the rest of Eliphaz's speeches to the rest of the book, I think that fits well, but of course that's my judgment. So any other thoughts? Questions? Would someone like to read verses 8 through 16 for us?
Sure. As for me, I would seek God, and to God would I commit my cause, who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. He gives rain on the earth and sends water on the fields. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty so that their hands achieve no success. He catches the wise in their own craftiness, and the schemes of the wily are brought to a quick end. Did you say 14?
Through 16.
They meet with darkness in the daytime and grope at noonday as in the night. But he saves the needy from the sword of their mouth and from the hand of the mighty. So the poor have hope, and injustice shuts her mouth.
So in verse 8, Eliphaz actually shifts to directly giving Job advice. Actually, earlier what he was doing is he was talking in the third person about things he's seeing. And, of course, that's meant that Job's supposed to learn from it, you know, from these general precepts. But now he actually says, as for me, right? So he's saying, this is what I would do if I was in your shoes, Job. And that very interesting question that Tom already brought up is he says, as for me, I would seek God. The question we have to ask, we might not be able to answer, is what does he mean by I will seek God? Is he saying I would seek God by acknowledging I'm in the wrong, right? I'm going to go into court and plead guilty. Is that seeking God? I'm not sure. It's hard to square seeking God with this God being kind of distant. So what do you guys think? Do you have any ideas at all? And I don't know that there's a clear answer to this, although one of you may have one. But what does he mean to seek God?
Well, for me, it's an interesting question, because all of the things that he says about God are experiential. So does it mean that the way that he's going to want to seek God is by looking around him for other things that God does and then attribute any unexplainable thing to just being a God thing, because you don't get it? So like verse 9, it's unsearchable, so it must be God. I don't know.
I think that's a really, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's just what came to mind. I don't know.
I think that's an interesting suggestion, because John's right that he talks in experiential terms. Eliphaz doesn't talk about having a personal relationship with God. I mean, that's a very important thing to see about his view of God as we flesh that out in this chapter. And so he's probably thinking about seeking God in terms of the things around him and experientially. And therefore, what would seeking God's favor, to put a little bit more definition in this, what would seeking God's favor mean if you're looking for God's favor to be expressed experientially? That's a hard question, but I want you to think about that one. Because this is, this helps us understand his view of God.
Say it again.
What does seeking God's favor, remember Job is not experiencing favor right now, what does seeking God's favor mean if you're thinking about this experientially? You're not thinking in terms of a dialogue with God where you speak and God speaks, but you're thinking of seeking God's favor so that your experiences in this world change.
It kind of reminds me of the view that the Greeks and the Romans would have of appeasing the gods to get what they want. So we have this kind of exchange. So rather there being a creaturely worship of a creator, there's more of like a bribery going on. I'll give you this if you give me that. So Job, go back now and see what you can do to seek God and get back on his good side.
Now, I think that's a really interesting idea. Stay with me, Michelle.
Oh.
Don't go hang up. So I think it's an interesting idea, but we're going to see if you've read a little bit in Job beyond these verses, that Eliphaz is not saying go bribe God with sacrifices, like you're going to feed God the way that Greeks, Romans, a lot in the ancient Near East did. So what is it that he should do to seek God? What has he got to do that's going to lead to getting God's favor? Any ideas?
No, I'll give that to someone else.
Anyone else have any ideas? We can wait a second because I think we're going to get the answer in the chapter.
Yeah.
This is where humility comes in?
They're saying be humble. But it can be broader than that. I mean, there's not just one way to say this.
To admit something wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so if he admits he does something wrong, you're thinking very much, though, in Christian terms, which I really appreciate because you're all Christians. But think of this in a non-dialogue way. Right? We're not talking about using words where Job speaks to God and God speaks to Job. But if we're sticking with John's suggestion, and I think this fits with Michelle, of experiential, right? I'm seeking God's favor and I'm going to experience that favor.
Is he accusing God of being unjust?
He is not accusing God of being unjust. Very important for Eliphaz, God is just.
No, I mean to in addressing Job, appeal your case to him that what's happening to you is not just. And the reason I say that is because in 16 it says, so the poor have hope and injustice shuts their mouth. But that's really talking about the poor, though, so I don't know.
Yeah, so I don't think that's it at all. I think what you're going to see is two things. One is Eliphaz's view of God is God does what is right. Right? We'll see that in just a second. I think we'll just go ahead and read it. God does what is right. And so what he's actually appealing to Job to do, well, let's see. I pointed out in verse 8 that he gives him a direct advice. Let's look at verses 11 through 13 together. Because now he starts talking about God. And I do think Christopher Ashe's title here of Be Humble is really helpful. This is speaking of God. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty so that their hands achieve no success. He catches the wise in their own craftiness, and the schemes of the wily are brought to a quick end. God is involved, and God is righting wrongs, according to Eliphaz. This is one of the reasons why I don't like the title deistic. It's very tempting for us to think Eliphaz is a deistic God because he's not presenting God with a mediator or a God who cares about Job in a very personal way, in a relational way. But the God that he does present is a God who is righteous and who rights wrongs, right? So he's not a deistic God who's far removed and unconcerned about the affairs of men. But on the other hand, Eliphaz's God is simply concerned about moral rights and wrongs, right? He's not the God of the true God of the Bible who cares about all your individual sufferings. I think that's how you fit verses 1 together with this section, right? The Bible tells us that God stores up your tears, as it were, in a bottle, and not a hair can fall to the ground apart from your fatherly care. Eliphaz doesn't talk about God as our Father who cares for us, who loves us. He's a very powerful, all-powerful perhaps being, who is about righting wrongs. And this works for his worldview because it means good people like him get good things. Bad people get bad things. And therefore, I actually think what he means by seeking God is behave better, right? If you humble yourself and you do the right things, God's going to lift you up. Now, there's actually a sense in which that's true. The Bible does say, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, and he will exalt you in due time. But how is Eliphaz's way of doing it wrong?
It's all on Job. So, like, Job has to stop being a fool, and Job has to not be crafty. So he doesn't, there's no reliance on God and the power of the Holy Spirit to help us be godly. It's experience answering experience. Like, do big things and then you get to be called godly.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So the right way of understanding humble yourself under the mighty hand of God and he will exalt you in due time is you humble yourself by seeking God's grace, and God gives you grace, right? Unmerited favor. That is not the calculus that Eliphaz has. Eliphaz is actually turning humility into a work, right? Humility is a good thing that you do that God rewards. By the way, this is a really, really slippery thing that many Christians fall into at different times in their lives. You come to realize that salvation is by grace alone. And then you start thinking of faith and humility and those sorts of things almost as though, or even as, good works that you do. So sure, it's not my money I give to the poor that gets me saved. It's my humility. And then the question is, just how humble do you have to be for God to reward you? Just how much faith do you have to have? How much do you have to love God? And you know, the answer, of course, is perfectly. And Jesus says, even if you've done it perfectly, you should say, I'm an unprofitable servant. All I've done is what's required. So we're missing here with Eliphaz because we don't have a Messiah. We don't have a mediator. We actually also don't have grace. I want to give you a different model here to think about Eliphaz as God instead of thinking deist. I think you want to think it's very similar to the Muslim idea of God. How many of you are familiar with Islam? But in Islam, God is absolutely all-powerful. That's true with Eliphaz as God. He's completely righteous. He punishes the wicked. He vindicates those who behave well. But you know what God isn't in Islam? He's not Father. If you tell a Muslim that God is your father and he's a serious Muslim, he will get upset with you. He will say, Allah is not father. He's master. And that's Eliphaz's view of God. He may be a very talented, distant CEO. You know, we can be grateful for that. He knows how to run the universe well. But he's not someone who cares about you personally and is putting away your sins. He's not dealing with you by grace. I'm going to put it in a crass way. I think Eliphaz is a little more sophisticated than this. He's dealing with you in terms of karma, right? You behave well, you get good things. You behave poorly, you get bad things. So be wise and behave well. And humility is simply, in Eliphaz's language, another work to be done. So even when we come to verse 16, where he says, so the poor have hope and injustice shuts her mouth, Eliphaz seems to be talking about the poor having hope that God, and I think here we might want to have a tricky question. We're talking like small g God, maybe, a higher power who's a great power, but not the God of the Bible, that this God will right injustices. This is not in a hope who got, in God who loves me and who gave himself for me, right? This is a God who's going to look at me where I'm getting injustice done to me. And because he's a morally upright God, he's eventually going to right the wrong. Now, I don't want to be unfair to Eliphaz here. There's a limit to how much we can tell simply by, you know, pulling a few lines of poetry out. But he doesn't seem to me to be treating humility as though it's a virtue that gets rewarded rather than a open hand that's receiving from God and saying, Lord, you are everything I need. Right? I don't bring anything to this equation. Eliphaz is saying, bring your humility to this deal. You bring humility, God will pay you back for it. I think that's exceedingly dangerous. Thankfully, we're not accepted or rejected by God on the basis of being humble enough. That'd be a terrible burden, by the way, and I know Christians wrestle with this sometimes when they turn faith into a work and they say the basis for my acceptance before God is my faith, and that's wrong. The basis for your acceptance before God is Jesus Christ, his finished work. Even if you try to put faith in that slot, you very quickly start thinking, is my faith good enough? And the answer, of course, is no, it's not. Because to be good enough, it would have to be perfect. Right? So please remember that we're saved by Christ. And it's the very thing that Eliphaz is leaving out, a perfect mediator. Other thoughts or questions on verses 8 through 16? I mean, in the abstract.
I have a question.
Okay.
So Eliphaz is basically not representing God correctly, right?
That is correct. In fact, the Lord himself says that in chapter 42.
Right. So is he also misrepresenting Job? That's a question I have. Because he's suggesting that Job needs to humble himself. Is he misjudging Job's heart?
He may be, and he certainly will be later in the letter. One of the things to think and keep in mind here is when you have that mechanism which says good people get good lives, bad people suffer, and you're one of the people that's being blessed, because remember these three friends, these are wealthy people with what would largely be considered good lives, and you're looking at Job who's suffering, it's very easy to start saying, it's your fault, right? And by the way, it's not just a misjudgment of Job, it's a misjudgment of themselves. One of the things we ought often to think, and they should have thought here, when we see other people suffering is, Lord, I deserve all of that and more. Thank you for the grace that you've given me, that instead of getting what I deserved, you're giving me all these blessings, right? But I do think that what we're going to see is the judgment against Job becomes sharper as we go from speech to speech, and they get frustrated that they're not making any progress. Commentators read this differently, but if we go back a little bit earlier in chapter 5, the way I read it is not that Eliphaz is saying, Job, you're a fool. I think that the way I read it is Eliphaz is giving generic wisdom and expecting to be honored for having this generic wisdom that actually doesn't apply to Job very well at all. But that I could be wrong. Other thoughts about that, about these verses? See the danger here of having something that's true, be realistic and be humble. Those are good things. But applying them in a bad way to someone else's life. We need to remember the power in the tongue. Life and death, the Proverbs tells us, is in the power of the tongue. And be very careful, particularly with those who are already bruised, in how we use our tongues. Let's go ahead and look at the remaining verses here. Would someone like to read verses 17? Let's read through 26. I want to hold off on 27. 17 through 26 for us.
I'll read.
Thank you.
Behold, blessed is the one whom God reproves. Therefore, despise not the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he binds up. He shatters, but his hands heal. He will deliver you from six troubles. In seven, no evil shall touch you. In famine, he will redeem you from death, and in war from the power of the sword. You shall be hidden from the lash of the tongue and shall not fear destruction when it comes. At destruction and famine you shall laugh and shall not fear the beasts of the earth.
26.
For you shall be in league with the stones of the field, and the beasts of the field shall be at peace with you. You shall know that your tent is at peace, and you shall inspect your fold and miss nothing. You shall know that your offspring shall be many, and your descendants as the grass of the earth. You shall come to your grave in ripe old age, like a sheaf gathered up in its season. Behold, this we have searched out.
Okay. No harm done. Thank you. Well, in the abstract, this is really good stuff, right? Despise not the discipline of the Almighty. That's a lesson that we all need to learn. We all need to tell ourselves in the abstract. Now, by discipline here, Eliphaz means corrective discipline. He's not simply talking about the discipline of hearing God teach, which we often explain to people when they're joining the church about church discipline. He's saying corrective discipline. Don't despise it. The Lord's disciplining you. He's chastising you to turn you from your error back to doing what is right. Well, sometimes that's a really important thing for us to hear. The problem is it's not true. Job is not suffering because God is disciplining him, because Job has been unfaithful in some way. We know that it's not true. And Eliphaz is simply making assumptions. But I want to say even more strongly than this, and I'd encourage you to try to think about this when you're reading through these speeches. It pains me to think of Job sitting right in front of me with his sores that he's scraping with a piece of pottery, mourning the death of all his sons, and listening to what Eliphaz is saying. Think about these words. He will deliver you from six troubles, in seven no evil shall touch you. That's not true. Right? It sounds good. It sounds like wisdom. But Job is here suffering horrendously bad. And he isn't suffering because of his sin. He's actually suffering because he was the most righteous man on earth and God was bragging about him. But I want to say, even if the person you're talking to doesn't happen to be the most righteous person on the face of the earth, it's probably not that helpful to give this sort of platitudes that hold out this language that sounds, oh, if you're a good person or if you just trust God, all these good things are going to happen to you, when it's not actually true. Now, I want you to think about the vision here from verses 22 to 26. Because in many ways, this is really beautiful stuff. Ron had mentioned earlier having to read Job as poetry, just in a poetry class in college. And think about the beauty of this and the vision it portrays for a life that we'd like to have. He says, at destruction and famine you shall laugh and shall not fear the beasts of the earth. For you shall be in league with the stones of the field, and the beasts of the field shall be at peace with you. You shall know that your tent is at peace, and you shall inspect your fold and miss nothing. You shall know also that your offspring shall be many, and your descendants as the grass of the earth. You shall come to your grave in ripe old age, like a sheaf gathered up in its season. Well, let's say that's a beautiful picture of a blessed life. And you probably would all like that to be true of you. The problem is, it's not true in general. It may be true of you. It's not true just because you happen to be righteous. Take these words and try to apply them, for example, to the Apostle Paul. Right? Does it really work out that well? You know, Paul gets beaten and thrown in prison and shipwrecked and so on. And Peter and John the Baptist, the greatest man up until the kingdom of God, according to Jesus, John the Baptist, is beheaded in prison. This is not actually true, even though it's a beautiful vision. But there's something else I want you to see. even to the degree that this is reflective in just a broad figurative way of the fact that God blesses his people, all he's giving Job is a beautiful vision. He's actually not giving Job hope because he has a vision separated from the promises of God in the mediator. See, apart from having Christ represent you, all this is wishful thinking. It may sound nice, but it's not true. Correspondingly, because you know the mediator, Jesus Christ, you have good news to preach to your own soul and to that of other people as well. By the way, I think this is an interesting point that Christopher Ashe makes. Eliphaz is encouraging Job to fear God for exactly the reason Satan had said that Job had always feared God. Isn't that interesting? But Eliphaz is encouraging Job to fear God so that he can have all these material blessings in this life. And that's the very thing that Satan had said. For the rewards that God gives to the pious, that's what he's offering, rather than because God is God. So Eliphaz, who I think from a human standpoint is a really good guy, right? He travels a great distance. He sits with Job for 7 days. He's probably been helpful to a lot of people. He's considered one of the wisest men of the day. And he actually ends up telling Job the very thing that Satan had accused him of. He's saying, Job, if you behave well, God will bless you in this life and make this life your best life now. Beloved, I hate to tell you this, but people do that in the church too, right? This is not something that went away 3,000 years ago, and it's not the right thing for us to be doing. So I didn't have a lot to say on that particular section, but I did want to point out one more thing and then take your questions, and that's verse 27. After Eliphaz gives this very long speech that takes two chapters, Eliphaz says, behold, this we have searched out. It is true. Hear and know that it is for your good. Eliphaz does not have a small opinion of himself. He is basically saying, I have spoken. The matter is settled. And I honestly think Eliphaz is thinking that when he finishes his speech, everybody's going to say, yes, Eliphaz, that is so wise. You are right. But he's going to find out there's another 37 chapters to the book. So, I would add, by the way, when you're giving people comfort, even when you're giving people advice, you probably don't want to be the judge at the end of it who says, by the way, this advice I'm giving you, it is entirely right. It is for your good. You ought to take it. Probably not that helpful. But thoughts or questions on this concluding section here of his first speech?
David, I have a question. Verse 17, is Eliphaz using the recognized name for God, this Almighty Shaddai, as if he's familiar with it?
I think the important thing to notice is he doesn't use the covenant name Yahweh, which Job will use, because he's talking about a very powerful God. That's why I don't necessarily like the idea of just a higher power, and I don't like the idea of deism, because this God is involved in the world. But he doesn't talk about God as the God who's in relationship with his people. And normally, this isn't 100% true, but normally in the Bible, when the Old Testament, when it's talking about God primarily in terms of his relationship with the people that he has bound himself to, that he cares about, we get Yahweh, which is Lord in all caps in our English editions. And Eliphaz does not use Yahweh in his speeches. So it is always a little bit of a balance as we're reading this. How much is he talking about the true God? And what I want to say is, when people talk about the true God, but they talk about him apart from Jesus Christ, in one sense, they're not really talking about the true God. And our Jewish friends who have the Old Testament, and they take it seriously, right? So you could read Orthodox Jews who are actually quite serious about God. They will think, of course, that God does have a relationship with the Jewish people. But when you take Christ out of it, you've actually taken out all our grounds of hope. And that's the biggest thing I want us to see about Eliphaz is not, not just that his idea of God as God in himself is wrong, although I do think we want to say that. He does not have a loving God who's in relationship with his people. I think the big thing to take away is he doesn't have a God who has a mediator. Did I wander too much on that, Tom? Do you want to come back on that?
No, it was helpful to me. Can I ask another question?
Sure.
So in verse 13, mm-hmm. he captures the wise by their own shrewdness, and the advice of the cunning is quickly thwarted. There's a cross-reference for 1 Corinthians 3, verse 19.
Yeah, that's fascinating, actually. Did you have a specific question? You just want me to talk about the connection?
I think it's amazing that someone like Eliphaz, who doesn't know God, is being quoted later by Paul.
Yeah, I wonder about this, actually. It's the only verse from Job that is quoted in the New Testament, right? Is that verse from Eliphaz's speech. And I actually think that Paul may be meaning this with a bit of irony in his own mind. That is, Paul is quoting this, and with the way Paul quotes it, it's absolutely true. But it's really interesting against the backdrop because Eliphaz is a guy who, in his own sense, even though he's saying these words, is a man who thinks of himself as the wise and the crafty. And Paul is going to say in 1 Corinthians that God has made foolish the wisdom of man. Right? So I don't know if you can see how that connection goes, and it's not important whether or not I'm right. But I think that Paul's mind was working in such a way that when Paul quotes Job, he's both quoting the words because they fit exactly what he wants to say, but he also has a sense of irony in it, in that his interlocutors are in the place of Eliphaz. Right? His interlocutors that Paul was dealing with in Corinth are people that were worldly wise, were very eloquent. By the way, Eliphaz here is very eloquent, and yet they missed the wisdom of God. So I can't prove that. That's just my own way of putting it together. Tom, do you have any other thoughts on that?
No, that helps too. I like that.
So, yeah. Paul, by the way, if you pay attention, he does do some really interesting, and I don't want to say this in the wrong way because I don't mean he's being tricky, but he does some very clever word plays and those sorts of things, and he likes irony. He'll use things talking about the true Jew is the one whose praise comes from God. And then you have to remember, Judah means praise. And Paul is intentionally making those sorts of word plays. And therefore, it doesn't seem odd to me that he would be thinking of this in an ironic way, even as he's making his main point. Any other thoughts on Eliphaz's speech as a whole?
Well, one thing I think is also ironic is that, you know, if you look all the way through verse 27 in that last section, and then you look at how God ended up blessing Job at the end of this, from Eliphaz's perspective, he would just go and say, "I told you I was right."
Yeah, God is going to vindicate you. Well, the problem with him saying, "I told you I was right," is God also tells Eliphaz, because God actually speaks to Eliphaz and tells him he's wrong at the end of the book. So Eliphaz is going to have a hard time getting away with, "I told you I was right." But, it's interesting, actually, the Lord addresses his words not to the three friends as a whole, but directly to Eliphaz. So Eliphaz, I think, we don't know what happens to him, but I think he should realize that he was, in fact, in the wrong, even though he says a lot of things that, from a human standpoint, could seem quite wise. Let me just do one follow-up on the doctrine of God from earlier that we were talking about, and because I do think it's important, and then hit on this concluding thing about the mediator. I think it's important to realize that Eliphaz has a high view of God in the sense that he thinks God is powerful, and he has a high view of God in the sense that he thinks God is righteous. He's a God who rights wrongs. That is, he has a Muslim view of God. But what he doesn't have is a view of a God that you know intimately, that you have a relationship with. And I want to suggest a big part of that is he doesn't have a view of a mediator. we're going to see this as a problem with all the friends. And one of the ways we want to read Job is to remember that we do have a mediator. And therefore, when we're offering advice to people, we ought not to be offering advice that works entirely on a be good things will happen to you sort of basis. Rather, we ought to be dealing with both those who are doing well and those who are suffering from the standpoint of God's grace. I think it might be useful to conclude tonight by thinking about how extreme Job's suffering was. In some ways, it's almost unimaginable to lose all your children in a single moment, to lose all your wealth, to lose your health, and to be just absolutely miserable. And nobody around you seems to understand. Even your wife, who we might presume had a loving relationship with Job, had said to him, curse God and die. It would be very easy for someone. No, we know this is wrong, but we should remember it's very easy for someone to come along and see someone suffering like that and to imagine this very thing that his friends are doing. There must have been something wrong in his life, and now he's getting his. Let me give you just an example from the Bible and then one from popular culture. I think I gave this one last week. When the disciples come to the gate and they see the man born blind, even though they have the book of Job, they ask Jesus, did this man sin or his parents that he was born blind? I think that's a reminder, but there's a certain default connection we have. And if you don't think that's true, let me tell you about modern American culture. I don't know how this is true in other parts of the world, but modern American culture, when we talk about helping the poor, it's not uncommon for people to start talking about helping the deserving poor, as though we can figure out which of them are suffering because they deserve to suffer, right? That's not an uncommon idea in our culture. And it's very different, however, from what Jesus says to the Good Samaritan. You know, the Good Samaritan comes down the road and he sees this man that's beaten and lying on the side of the road. He could very easily have said, wow, this guy must have done a lot of bad stuff in his life to have something like this happen to him. And besides, the priests and the Levites are going by. But he helps him. And he doesn't help him because he's a deserving sufferer. He helps him simply because he's his neighbor and he had compassion on him. We should remember God's calling us to do that and to be really, really reluctant to look at other people's lives and say they brought it on themselves. But keep in mind, I am not saying that people don't bring problems on themselves. I've brought problems on myself. I trust that all of you can say the same thing. You have brought problems on yourself, but we need to be really, really careful that we don't set ourselves up as the judges so that when we see people suffering, we say, well, you know, it's your own fault, right? That's really not a good idea. We are not called to love our neighbor because they are worthy. We are called to love them because Christ does. I think it's also helpful for us to consider someone who suffered a great deal more than Job. And that, of course, is Jesus. Because you think about this very same judgment that people make on suffering. What did people say when they saw the suffering of Jesus? When they saw him being beaten? When they saw him being crucified? They actually said he must have been a really awful human being who blasphemed God. Because accursed is the man who is hung on a tree. As Isaiah so memorably put it, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. As one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastisement which brought us peace was laid upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. I want you to realize that when people looked at Jesus, they thought he was suffering for his own guilt. We know he wasn't. He was suffering for ours. And because we know he was suffering for ours, we actually have a mediator, and therefore we actually have comfort, both for ourselves, but also comfort to give to other people. So remember, when you see people suffering, the most important thing you can do for them is tell them about Jesus, right? That's really the point.